So, it's been a few weeks, but we left off in the middle of chapter 2 of Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah. And so we're going to try and pick up where we left off. Do a little bit of a refresher, but actually we don't want to get too tied into it because we're going to be moving on to a new topic shortly. And as I mentioned before, and as is really important to keep in mind, if you're finding this particular topic rather arduous, all the philosophical language, don't worry. That's not actually what the Mishneh Torah is at all. This is just this rather strange diversion, a prologue almost, before we dive into the real meat and potatoes of the book. So we last week...
Sorry, Adam, before you do that, can I just ask one little question?
Anything.
Which was from the last time you met. I can't remember when it was. But I just kind of didn't quite understand it. You were talking about... Oh, no, yeah, well, it wasn't you. I suppose it was Maimonides. It was talking about angels and the hierarchy of angels.
Yes.
Yeah. So what I want to ask you is where did that come from? Does that Maimonides, is that his opinion or where does he get that information from to make that, I don't know, it's an explanation, it's a summary, it's a, whatever it is.
Yeah, where does it come from? It's a great question because it's a very confident taxonomy of something which obviously we can't know a great deal about. And here he is saying, here's the 10 categories, here's what they're called, here's the order. It's a natural thing to look at and go, well, how do you know that? I don't actually know whether there's a source that he's drawing on other than just trying to synthesize all the Talmudic sources that he's familiar with. I think this probably is a bit of original kind of creative work where he's taking all of the different texts that reference different names for angels and trying to organize them. But he doesn't admit that if that's the case. He treats everything as though it is a well-known fact that this is the reality, when actually I think he's often more creative than he gives himself credit for. That said, I suspect, and I have no actual evidence of this because I haven't done the work, but I suspect that there's probably some resonance here with Islamic literature that he was very familiar with of the time, which probably had similar interest in trying to categorize and understand the phenomenon of angels. As I think we mentioned a little bit last time, right, in Islam, angels and how angels function are terrifically important. Believing in angels is actually one of the kind of inviolable beliefs of Islam. You have to believe in angels. I don't know that that is an inviolable belief of Judaism, and he hasn't said you must believe in angels, but he has said with a surprising degree of confidence, here's how angels work. So I suspect there's some influence there from the text that he was familiar with and discussions that were taking place around him. And he's applying what is likely a Muslim approach to taxonomy and a rational categorization of angelic beings to the Talmudic texts, which are never meant to be this orderly. It feels a bit like he's trying to force a round peg into a square hole, which is a phenomenon we may see many times. You know, his project, we've talked a little bit about it before, but we really see it as we go along. His project of the Mishneh Torah is unlike any other in that he is trying to put forward a cohesive, comprehensive understanding of Jewish law, which has no sources. And that's why people are so angry, but also why it's survived to be probably the most significant work of Jewish law ever written. So it's, you know, controversial. And the angels is a good example because many people, there's lots of yeshivot, which will learn Mishneh Torah, but they won't learn this first section. They'll skip over this first section, Yesodei HaTorah, and just start with the second.
Okay.
Jackie, you okay? You look surprised. You're on mute. I can't hear you.
No, I said there was a message from Sarah saying, when do we start on the WhatsApp? I just saw pop up.
Oh, no, I missed that. Okay.
Literally just came up. It's like, when are we starting? But I don't know what... Maybe she's trying to get into the other WhatsApp, not this...
She is here now.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Yes. Okay, so let's just quickly remind ourselves. We got a little hint with the angels of where we were before. We looked at the beginning of chapter 2, the forms of the angels, the fact that angels don't have a body, what exactly they do, which is ultimately to be this kind of chain of causation, where rather than being beings that have a distinct identity, there are beings which are in relation to each other in an almost mechanistic, naturalistic way, like synapses in the brain. One pops off and the next one pops off, and that's how angels carry messages. So when he says angels, he doesn't really mean at all what we conceive of in the modern West, which is this Christian mythological notion of a being with a halo and a harp and a flowing white cloak. That would be very far from what he has in mind, it seems. And this last halakha, number 8, which we looked at, he really lays out this bigger picture that all of these things that he's discussing are alive, all have a knowledge and relationship with the Creator. Even the most high of them, those who are the most primary in the chain of causation, have a relationship with the Creator, which is based on their intellectual capacity. And even those are limited. They can never really fully know God. And if that's true of the highest level, the most primary level, all the more so it's true of all the ones that come after it. The further away you get, all the way down to the 10th level, which the angels are called Ishim, men that we actually are encountering in the stories of the Torah and elsewhere, they barely have any conception of God because their intellectual capacity is so much more limited. And if they, who are still angels, have such a limited capacity, then, you know, we're kind of hosed. So Maimonides lays out this real concrete sense that we are unable to know God in any meaningful way. We can never know God, as he says, as God knows God's self. Hakol einan yod in habore kamo shehu yode atzmo. No one can know God in that intimate way. But there are different levels, and some are a lot closer than others, which is a pretty important distinction. So we're going to pick up now with Halacha 9 and continue as we have been reading the Hebrew, looking at the English. This English is flawed, but all English is flawed. But we'll try and rely on it as much as we can to help us clarify what it is we're learning. So we're continuing the exact same theme, Halacha 9. Kol ha-nimsa'im chutz min ha-borei mitzura ha-rishona ad yatosh katan shihiye betabur ha-aret ha-kol mikoach amitato nimsa'u. So everything that exists, all created things, all things that are, really, kol ha-nimsa'im, all that is found, literally, except for the Creator, from that very first form, mitzura ha-rishona, from that first form, until the tiniest little mosquito that lives in the depths of the earth, all of it came into being from the truth, or the power of the truth of God's being. It's very hard to translate this. Mikoach amitato nimse'u, right? So from the power of God's truth, or literally his truth here, they came to be. What exactly that means, I think in a technical way, it's hard to envision, but we certainly can get the vibe, right? Which is that every living thing, whether it's this most foundational angelic being, which is beyond all our conception, or the tiniest little gnat that we just swat away without thinking, all of them exist only because they're dependent on God. Life itself is in many ways just a reflection of God's presence on earth. All life, capital L, regardless of what sort it might be, including those that we don't like. Notably, he uses the example of a mosquito, which I think is telling, because it's obviously not the way we usually think about living beings. This is a biocentric conception of God. God is living things. God is the biomass. And that's how we encounter God's being, is through those things which come into existence through the force of God's truth. Ulefi shehu yodea atzmo. And because God knows God's self, remember that was the thing no creature can do, umakir gedulato v'tifarto v'amitato, and can recognize God's own greatness and beauty and truth, hu yodea hakol, God knows everything, v'ein davar ne'elam mimenu, and there's nothing which is hidden from God. So this is a kind of theological principle, which in technical language is called omniscience, right? That God knows everything. It's not, importantly, the same as omnipotence, which is that God does or can do everything. Maimonides and Judaism has a complicated relationship with the idea of omnipotence, actually. It's largely something which is very prominent in Islam, but Judaism never quite picked up the same way. Certainly the Torah doesn't have an idea of an omnipotent God. Nor, by the way, you could argue, does the Torah have an idea that God knows everything. Notably, there's many times where God has to ask questions to find out information. Whether that's just an act is a different question, I suppose. But even in the Garden of Eden, God walks around having lost Adam and Eve and asking, where are you? Where are you gone? So Maimonides is here constructing a kind of theological argument, not really a textual one. Notably, there's no proof texts at this point. Okay, so two important concepts in this halakha. Everything that exists does so because of God's power. That's the power of life. God is literally the life force behind all animated things. And because God knows fully God's self, which is all living things, right? As a result, God knows the nature of the world and nothing is hidden. This is common language, particularly from the Machzor. We talk about this a lot at Yom Kippur, right? There's nothing hidden from God. There's nothing that can be unknown. Okay, we get a bit technical with this, but hang on, because it's really not that complicated. It just uses a lot of fancy language. HaKadosh Baruch Hu makir amito v'yodea ota kamo shehi. So the Holy Blessed One, again, we change names for God constantly, purposefully, in the Mishneh Torah, recognizes God's truth and knows it as it is, kamo shehi, as it is, as it actually is. Ve'eino yodea b'de'a shehi chutz mimenu kamo she'anu yodin. God doesn't know things with the sort of knowledge which is outside of God's self, chutz mimenu, kamo she'anu yodin, like we know things. So the fundamental principle here is that when we talk about God knowing, yoda, right, this word that comes up so often here, we talk about God knowing. God's knowing is ontologically different from our knowing. We know things. How do we know things? We read Wikipedia. We have an experience. We learn things through our interactions. We learn things through reading. We learn things through what other people tell us. But our understanding, our knowing, is not the same thing as God's knowing. So when we think of, oh yeah, God knows all the secrets, as we say in the Machzor, we don't mean that kind of God can just read everyone's mind. It's actually a fundamentally different thing. It's a knowing which comes from the fact that God is everyone's mind rather than is outside of it, reading it. That's this principle here about this. There's no third party exteriorization of this knowledge. God is the knowledge. Which he makes even clearer. She'ein anu v'da'atenu echad, right? Ourselves and our knowledge are not the same thing. This is, you could prove this, right? This is quite a big principle here. You could prove this even perhaps by using the example of memory loss, right? We can exist without the same knowledge. We are not our knowledge. Babies know very little, as I'm well able to evidence, and yet they are distinct from the things they know because they change the things they know. Aval ha-borei yitbarach, but the Creator, may God be blessed, hu v'da'ato v'chayav echad. So he, we're going to use the masculine language because Rambam does, he and his knowledge and his life are all the same thing. It's actually lives because of the nature of Hebrew, it's plural. So God, what God knows, and the way in which God exists in living things throughout the universe are all the same thing. They're not distinct things. They're not like, oh, that's God's knowledge and that's God's being and that's God's life. That is simply what we're talking about, is a force of truth, as he refers to it, which is actually the same as the knowledge, the same as the being. It's all one thing, which is really hard for us to understand. Right? He says, Mikol tzad, from every side, Mikol pina, and from every corner, V'chol derech yichud, and in every possible way of talking about unity. So it's actually quite fancy language for Rambam. Mikol tzad, Mikol pina, V'chol derech yichud. In every possible way that you can conceive of it, God is united. There's no distinction. There's not God and God's knowledge. There's not God and something else. Notably, the thing that comes to my mind here, which he hasn't addressed, but he will elsewhere, is what is God's name then? Because we talk all the time about God and God's name, right? Hu, Baruch Hu, Uvaruch Shemo, we say in synagogue all the time, blessed is God and blessed is God's name. Seems to be contradictory in some way to this idea of seeking always to see things as united. But maybe that's the problem with names. That's a different question. Okay, so do we have a good sense here of what this means? I mean, it's very hard to conceive of, because when we know this information, we're exemplifying the exact kind of knowledge we're not seeking to understand, right? Our knowledge is impossible. We can't know the way that God knows. Even knowing this fact, we can't know it the way that God is in a relationship of knowledge. And to Rambam, this is really important. because he's approaching things in a very intellectual way, and it's important that he make it clear here that when we talk about God knowing, it doesn't mean what we think, which is usually his kind of standard line. It's not what you think it is. So we're now on this hypothetical. We love a hypothetical. In the English, it starts here with were he to live life as is. She'ilmale haya chai b'chayim, if God lived the way that we live, v'yodea b'deya, and knew with knowledge, right? Lived with life and knew with knowledge, very Hebrew constructions. Chutz mimenu hayu sham elohut harbehu, v'chayav v'dato. If this were the case, then there would actually be many gods. There'd be God, and there'd be God's life, and there'd be God's knowledge, and they'd all be distinct gods. Yeah, Robin.
Sorry, I think this sort of relates to something I asked last time. It's interesting that he separates out knowledge as the one aspect of our being other than life. Do you see what I mean? Like, think of emotion or love or, you know, as other things that are not knowledge.
I suppose it's a result of him prioritizing intellectual activity and rational thinking. Is like, what makes you a person? Well, there's your life, right? Your livingness, your animating spirit, and then there's the stuff you know.
But there's sort of something about emotion that feels missing there to me. I don't know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a question perhaps of whether what he means by knowledge includes everything that we would think of as being neurological activity, the mind, or whether he means strictly the stuff you know, the facts of knowledge. I suspect it's probably closer to the first, but he doesn't you know, define his terms in ways that we would understand. So we have to kind of try and... Yes, there's lots of interesting scholarship based on, you know, the Arabic language that he primarily wrote in and the words he uses in the Guide for the Perplexed in Arabic, where actually there's lots of different shades of words that you might use for knowledge, and they don't always mean exactly the same thing. Here he's writing in Hebrew. This is not a translation, right? He wrote this in Hebrew, but Hebrew wasn't his first language, and he's writing it in a constructed sort of way, and we have no idea what he means when he says da'at. We only know what we usually mean when we say da'at. I suspect it's closer to mind in the way we use it.
Yeah.
Because I think he means like, it's almost like we're talking about kind of the fact of being alive, and then there's the fact of consciousness, right? Which is now a word we have that he didn't. And actually, maybe that's the best word for da'a here, is like, God is consciousness, but we have consciousness, right? We and our consciousness are two distinct things. We can be unconscious, right? We talked about earlier when we started, people kindly asked about Michaela's and experience with general anesthesia. It's a weird thing to be under anesthesia, right? You're there, you're alive, but your consciousness is removed. And in that sense, we actually have these two distinct elements, our living being and our consciousness that allows us to process that. That probably, I'm just thinking aloud, but I think actually that's probably closer to what he's getting.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
God's living being is consciousness. Right, there's no separating them. And actually, what's funny, right, is we're starting to sound like real woo-woo kind of, you know, new age. God is consciousness. God is life. God is the intellectual comprehension of the universe. But that's what he's talking about, right? We're not hopefully putting words in his mouth. Apologies to Rambam's ghost, which he wouldn't believe in if we are. But it's certainly the case that he's talking about these things in ways that feel very modern. If we understand the words the way that I think we should. This is the challenge of translation, right? We see knowledge and we have a certain conception of it, but is that what he meant by Dea? Maybe not. I like the idea that maybe we're talking here about the force of life versus the force of consciousness. And that in God, those are inseparable. God can't be unconscious. I suppose that's what he means when he says God knows everything, right? It's like there's no ability to have a less conscious or unconscious God. There's no anesthesia.
You may not be able to see it, but Sarah keeps pushing up her hand.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Sarah.
Do you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
I just want to say that it seems to me as if We can't think about God as separate things. Like everything, what we separate, we call feeling, we call thinking. That is not what maybe the Rambam mean about God.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And what I want to ask you, what about past, present, and future?
Well, that's such a good example. Can't we look? Right? I mean, that's such a good example in many ways, because the Torah itself gives us the way of understanding God through the strange name that God self-identifies with to Moses. Yeah. As being Haya Hove Nihye, right? And that isn't actually spelled out in the Torah, by the way. We just commonly understand it that way. But God does say, right, Ehye Asher Ehye. And it's inevitable, if you're a Hebrew speaker, as you well know, that when you see Yud, He, Vav, He together, what comes to mind are all those different conjugations of the verb Haya, to be. You've got the past tense, the present tense, or the participle, and the future tense, all represented by one word that is unpronounceable. Right? How do you say was, is, will be at the same time? You can't, because for us, they're all separate. Yeah. But the idea of an unpronounceable name that represents those three things is actually really deep and amazing, because it would imply that in some way we can't even say what God is, because in our conception, in our language, in our knowledge, those things are distinct. But what we're trying to understand through language itself is they're not. And that's the problem, right? Rambam's trying to explain something in language that is ultimately a mystical experience of unity, of oneness, of a supra-rational conception of the divine. But he's trying to put it in a book. So I think we have to kind of, in some way, infer what he's trying to convey while not getting too worried about the particular language choices, because I don't think the particular words actually matter that much. What matters is the concept, as you say, of unity and the failure of our ability to understand that complexity.
Can I
say
something? Just wanted to bring in the first bracha of the Shemona Esrei, the first bracha after the initial, the first three, so number four, but one of the extras in the daily prayer. For those that don't know, I'm talking about the one that starts Atachonin Ladam Daat Umlamed Lenosh Bina. Singers translated, because that's the one I've got at hand. You favor man with knowledge and teach mankind understanding. Favor us with the knowledge, the understanding, and the insight. Blessed are you, the great gracious giver of knowledge. This Nusach Svard, just to say, instead of saying Choneinu Me'etcha De'Abina V'Haskel, say Choneinu Me'etcha De'Chochma Bina V'Dad.
That's the influence of Kabbalah. And the
exactly. Yeah, so, as you know, yeah. Exactly. So the idea here is, I suppose, just that these different words of Da'at, which we've been talking about, of that consciousness, of that knowledge, what is the difference? The mindfulness, Bina, understanding, is the way we translate it in today's world, but again, it's a form of knowledge. Haskel, intellect, these words are just so interchangeable, and what we're asking for. So when we're talking about God knowing everything, he's got the knowledge, or has he got the intelligence, or because we're asking for him to give it to us as well. So just that whole idea of
it's
that
a
thought
fascinating
of what you're
phrase,
saying,
isn't it? The idea of chonen hada'at, that God is the one who graces, right? Who gives over knowledge.
Yes.
The fact that our knowledge is, by that definition, not actually our own. It's a gift. It's borrowed. It's very Jewish, isn't it? The first thing we pray for, and it is the first thing, because the first three, as you say, are stock, components. The first unique part of it is saying, right, we need knowledge. And there's a great way to read the Shemona Esrei, that each of the brachot follows the other. So we need knowledge first before we can then be able to do tshuva, before we can then be able to ask for forgiveness, all the things that come after. So maybe it's not so strange Rambam is obsessed with knowledge, because it's a very Jewish thing to be concerned about, thinking about what the primary categories of existence are. Okay. So we were in the middle of this hypothetical. Let's just revisit it quickly. If it were the case that God lived life as we do, and God knew things the way that we do, then there would be lots of gods, right? And I think there's an easy way to understand this, which is to think about Greek myths, right? Where Zeus lives life the way that we do and knows things the way that we do. And as a result, Zeus is not omniscient, obviously. And that's why there needs to be multiple gods, because it's shared out between all these different beings. So that makes a certain kind of logical sense. But Rambam, of course, is not suggesting we believe in Zeus, in case that's a newsflash to anyone. Ein hadavar ken. Right? This is not the case. Ela echad mikol tzad. It's great. It rhymes too. One from every side. One in every way. Every type of oneness is applicable. Umikol pina, and from every corner. The same language seen before. Uvechol derech yichud, and in every single, every type, every way, every path into oneness. There is no way of unification which is not applicable to God. Nimseta ta omer. Hu hayodea vehu hayadua vehu hadea atzma hakol echad. Right, and he writes this in a really interesting way. So he says nimseta taomer, which is his way of saying, listen, you could say it this way: God is the knower hayodea, and God is the known hayadua. Right, that's the passive participle, and God is hadea atzma, the knowledge itself. So in our life, there's the knower. There's the thing that's known, and there's the knowledge, the way in which that information is passed on. God is all three of those things at once. And it very much resembles exactly what we said a minute ago of was, is, will be, right? We don't have words to convey those things simultaneously. All we can do is say they're all one thing. As he says, all different sides, all different corners. V'devar ze ein koach bepe leomro. Right, this thing is not a force which we have the ability to speak of with our mouths. Right, we literally can't talk about this. It's beyond our abilities to speak of. Velo ba'ozen l'shom'o, and beyond the ability of our ears to hear it. Velo b'lev ha'adam l'hakiro al borio, and it's beyond the ability of the mind of humanity to recognize it in its full depth. In its entirety, as the translation has here, which is a good one. And so we can't actually fully understand this. We can only grasp at it and get a sense of it, and then we lose it. There's a common Kabbalistic phrase drawn from Yechezkel of ratzo v'shuv, which is to run and return at the same time, almost like vibration. And the Kabbalists often talk about these mystical insights that kind of, you get it and then you lose it. You get it and you lose it. It's a bit like when you wake up from a dream and you're trying to remember it. You can't quite hold on to it. And Rambam says the same about this truth regarding God's knowledge. We can't really fully understand it, but if we contemplate it, we can get a sense of it and hang on to it briefly. Ulefikach omer che faro v'che nafshecha v'ein omer che Hashem ela chai Hashem. This is interesting. It draws us back to the Siddur, by the way, and this is a very controversial aspect of the Siddur and the prayer Yishtavach. And you can look at your own Siddur and see which one it has, but Rambam has strong opinions about it. He says, therefore, Genesis, and this is from Genesis 42, in talking about Paro, about Pharaoh, describes Chei Paro, right? Pharaoh's lives, although it's usually understood singular, in Hebrew it's plural. Or it uses the phrase, and this is from the book of Samuel, Chei Nafshecha, right? The lives of your soul. But Samuel doesn't say Chei Adonai, right? But rather Chai Adonai, which is God is alive. So it might seem silly, right? And to those who don't spend a lot of time with Hebrew grammar, you're like, what's the difference? But that one little change from Chei, which is Chaim in Smichut for the nerds out there, to Chai, which is actually a present participle, is huge. Because when we talk about people, we say, oh yes, Chei Nafshecha, the lives of their soul. We talk about God. God doesn't have a lives. God is life. That's why it's Chai Adonai.
Also, by the way,
most benchers will have both. This is the debate, right? This is the debate. Is from Rambam's point of view, it's really important we say Chai Olamim. because what that means is God is the life of all worlds, not something which lives in the worlds. And we might think, what, who cares? But we can understand where he's coming from with this whole discussion of Hayodea, Hayadua, Vadea, Asma, that we need to try and find a way to understand these things as one and united. And seeing God as life, capital L, rather than alive, is in many ways a useful way to do that. Again, he's repeating partially here, but it's because it's so critical. She'ena bore v'chayav shnayim, right? God and God's life are not two different things. Kamo chayei agufim, like the life of bodies. Achayim o kechayei amalachim. Right, so it's not like the life of bodies that are living, or like the life of angels, which don't even have bodies but are still alive, because that kind of alive means that you're either alive or dead. And so your body is either alive or dead. What we're talking about is life, capital L. Lefikach eno makir haberuim v'yod am mechamat haberuim kamo she'anu yod'in otam ele mechamat atzmo yeda'im. Quite an interesting verb vowel there. So therefore, God doesn't recognize, makir is to recognize creation in the terms, in the way in which creation recognizes each other, but rather God knows the things that are created through God's self. So this is kind of a question of relationship, right? God and a mosquito, to go back to where we started in this rather long halakha, are not actually two distinct things. There's not God and then there's the mosquito. The reality is that God is the mosquito and every other thing which lives, which is actually quite a radical theology, not the one that most people were taught at Cheder, but one that actually is quite well supported in Jewish tradition. And Rambam doesn't really spell it out. By the way, here's this radical idea, but it is a radical idea. That God is capital L life, not just something that can be found within living things. And the knowledge, the life, the being, all of them are interchangeably united. Lefikach mipnei shehu yodea atzmo, yodea hakol. Therefore, because God knows God's self, God knows everything. It's a real type of Socratic, know thyself. Hakol, shehakol nismachlo behavayato, because everything is relying on, is leaning on, is drawn from God's existence. Everything is dependent on God. So God doesn't need to know, to think. You know, if God wants to know something, God doesn't actually have knowledge, which is separate. God just simply is and knows and recognizes and conceives of in a way that is totally unlike the way that we do those things. The intellectual process is not distinct. There's not God and God's mind, as there is for us. There's not life and consciousness, as there is for us. There's just one thing. Which, if you're finding it hard to understand, that shouldn't be surprising, because he said we can't really understand it. We can only get marginally closer to understanding it through thinking about it in depth. I love this concept he introduces as well in this next one. We're on number 11 here. Devarim elu she'amarnu be'inyan ze b'shnei prakim elu kamo tipa min hayam hem. Right? Hem mima she'sarich leva'er b'inyan ze. Excuse me, I stopped too soon. The concepts, the ideas, these things which we have spoken about in this idea, in this philosophy, in this conception, in these two chapters, the chapter first and the second chapter, which we're in now, they're like a drop in the sea. The space that is necessary to explain these matters is tremendous, right? There's no way he could possibly explain it to us. It's like a drop in the ocean, as we still say today, even 1,000 years later, in a different language, same idiom. Uve or kola ikarim shebishnei prakim elu hu hanigra maase merkava. And the in-depth explanation, the biur, the unpacking of all of these concepts in these two chapters is called in Hebrew Maase Merkava. It's quite a loaded statement for him to make, which won't be obvious if you're not familiar with a lot of the rabbinic literature. But the rabbis established in the Mishnah and Chagiga that there are two disciplines of knowledge which are mystical, esoteric, and off-bounds to most people. One is called Maase Breshit, meaning the work of creation, and the other is called Maase Merkava, the work of the chariot, Merkava being a reference to Ezekiel's vision in chapter 1 of his book. Rambam controversially says, no, it's not Ezekiel. When we say Maase Merkava, what we mean are these concepts, these philosophical understandings of God's being, of, you know, what he's saying ultimately by referencing it as Maase Merkava, is I know this is radical and controversial, and it's not something we teach everyone. The idea that God is capital L life is not public consumption knowledge, because it's actually quite an unsettling and destabilizing notion to throw into the religious soup that he is cooking. And he's aware of that. That's what he's telling us by saying, I know it's Maase Merkava, is you're not really supposed to talk about it. The Mishnah Chagiga says that Maase Merkava can only be taught to one student. And even then, you can only teach the student the chapter headings, and you have to let them guess at all of the actual content. So he's not doing that. Maybe he's doing that. Maybe in his mind, what he's doing is giving us just the bare minimum, a tipa minayam, a drop in the ocean. And we have to go and continue to extract from that limited understanding what he's really saying, which is way more radical than it seems theologically. I mean, think about how different our conception of religion is or would be. I don't know what individual people's theology is. If we said actually that God is life itself, capital L, that's what God is. That's what we mean. That's what we pray to and for. That's what we think of. That's way far from, you know, old man Skybeard. And that's good. That's what Rambam wants. He wants us to get very far from that. But it also would absolutely not pass muster in contemporary quote-unquote orthodoxy. Right? Rambam would be labeled a reformed Jew in 10 seconds if people took this the way that we're talking about it. And that's part of the reason, perhaps, that Mishnei Torah has remained somewhat controversial, is the people who understand what he's saying here understand that it's really radical. Okay, let's just... can we do it? Yeah, I think we can do it. Let's just finish the chapter, and then there's some to comprehend here. He's continuing this thread about Maase Merkava, and it's worth just understanding what he's trying to tell us, because he's connecting it to this passage in Chagiga and the concept about who can teach this. I already referenced it a little bit, but he explains it as well. Sivu ha-chamim arishonim shelo lidrosh bidvarim elu ela le'ish echad bilvad. So our sages, the early sages, ha-chamim arishonim, commanded... Sivu, mitzvah, that no one should interpret these things other than to one person alone. You can only teach it to one student. And it has to be someone who is wise and understands on his own. Exactly as we said, you can't explain it. You can't spell it all out. After that, you can hand over to him the chapter headings, Rashei Aprakim. Umodiinoto shemetz minadavar v'hu mevin midato. After that, you can give him a little tiny bit of the knowledge, only the basic outline, and he's going to continue to learn, and then eventually he'll understand more on his own. V'yeda sofa davar v'umko, and he'll come to know the end of the matter and its depth. Right, but it's a really interesting pedagogical method here, which is to say, here's some secret knowledge. I can tell you only the most basic stuff, and then you've got to go and find out the rest on your own. And I can only teach one person. Right, imagine being a teacher of Torah who takes this really seriously and chooses throughout their entire life the one person they'll pass on this secret knowledge to. Of course, great irony that he's writing this down in a book intended for public consumption while telling us, yeah, you're only supposed to teach this to one person. He must really believe that he's only giving us the barest hint. He must really think that. And so we have to do the same work that he's suggesting that the Hachamim tell us we need to do, which is to draw out more, lead Rosh to interpret. Udevarim elu devarim amukim hem. These things are deep things. Ad lim od, the deepest there is. Ve'en kol da'at v'da'at ru'uya l'savlan. And not every mind here, consciousness, mind, knowledge, whatever, is capable or fitting to comprehend them. Not everyone's going to get it. This isn't for everyone. Rambam's quite an elitist. Ve'alehem amar Shlomo behochmato derech mashal. About these secret things, Solomon spoke in a parable, Kivasim Lilvushecha. Kind of a weird parable, by the way, because what it means is sheep or lambs to act as your clothing. The translation explains a little bit, which is that the root of the word for lamb or sheep, keves, can also mean hide, as in to hide something, to be hidden. Kach amru hachamim befeirush mashal zeh. So our sages explained when looking at this particular parable. Devarim shehen kivshono shel olam yihyu lilvushecha, klomar lecha levarecha ve'al tidrosh otam berabim. So things which are secrets of this world will act as your clothing. That is to say, they'll be for you alone and do not discuss them in public. Kind of a weird interpretation, because your clothing is actually the thing on the outside. It's a thing people see rather than the thing that's hidden on the inside. I feel like this is backwards. I don't know if people interpret other ways. It's worth looking in more. I don't know as well where he says, the sages interpret it this way. I don't actually know where that is, although there's plenty of sourcing done so that you can find it. But he does go back to Shlomo and the book of Proverbs, quoting, "Ihyu lecha levadecha ve'ein lezarim itach." These will be for you and only you, and not for the strangers who are with you. And so there's a sense of exclusivity here as well. Ve'alehem amar, about them it said, the them is the secret knowledge, the principles of this chapter. Devash v'chalav tachat l'shonech, honey and milk under your tongue. Yeah, Jackie.
Where does all this secrecy thing come from?
Well,
it sounds very Masonic.
Yes, it is. It's definitely mystical, which is funny because people definitely have a conception that Rambam is not a mystic.
Yeah.
But he really is going to great lengths to tell us, if you read these two chapters that we've now read, we were almost at the conclusion here of the second, and you think, okay, that's cool, and you move on, fine, you're one of the normies. But if you're the kind of person who read these two chapters and went, whoa, there's a lot more to that than he's saying, and you start to think on it and dwell on it and draw more out of it, then this is the hint for you that you're on the right track.
But why keep it a secret?
I genuinely think it's because he thinks, as he said, let's go back a little bit. He said above here, and I think this is the motivating factor overwhelmingly, is ein kol da'at v'de'at ru'uya l'savlan. Most people can't handle it. He thinks it's dangerous, right? Not every mind can be fitting for this.
So if you actually reach that stage, you kind of just don't tell anybody.
Yeah. That's the amazing thing about Jewish mysticism, is that there's a very elitist conception. This is true in other religions as well. This is certainly true in Sufi Islam, right? That actually there's an understanding that 99% of Muslims are going to, you know, observe the surface level understanding of Islam, follow the commandments, read the Quran, practice their daily, the prayers and everything else. And then a small fraction, the enlightened, right, the brotherhood, those who have been inducted into the truths and the secrets of the inner meaning, they'll know the truth and they'll see it differently. But they're going to keep it to themselves because the normies out there can't handle it. And Rambam has a similar approach, actually. He's looking to appeal to the person who's interested to go deeper, but he's not interested to be totally explicit about what he's saying. If he was explicit, right, he'd be saying, actually, your conception of God is wrong. And God is actually something way more abstract. Life itself, capital L, right? This is what we're talking about here. And he says it, he hints at it, he references it, and we've stopped and looked at it in great detail. But you could easily read this and go, okay, cool. God knows stuff different than how we know stuff, whatever. The deeper level is not necessarily a requirement to get through the chapter. But he's stopping us to say, if you want, there's more here than you think.
And nowadays it would be, and that's in my next book.
Yes. Next week on the Mishneh Torah. It wasn't serialized. So there's no interest in saying, you know, trying to capture people's attention. But he does take, you know, notice, by the way, he started this halakha by saying, Tzivu hachamim rishonim. It's not the sages told us, not the sages suggested, it's they commanded us. And this is all coming from those Mishnaot and Chagiga that talk about Maaseh Merkava. He really believes that it is a requirement that if you understand the truth of these matters, that he's discussed in these two chapters, the angel, the knowledge, God's being, God's oneness, you have to be careful with how you talk about them, because not everyone is fit to understand them fully. And few people are fit to understand them at all. And the fewer that actually understand them a little bit then have to contemplate them in great depth, understand them more, and no one can understand them fully. Which is rather a demotivating approach to this sort of knowledge, right? He's not trying to motivate people to come into it. He's trying to say, you know, this is not for you. But nothing is more appealing than someone who says, this is not for you. One of my favorite books, a great kind of strange horror fiction book, which I encourage you to read if you want nightmares, called House of Leaves. The dedication page in the book just says in perfectly old-fashioned courier typeface, this is not for you, the big full stop at the end. And I remember I was like 16 when I read it for the first time, being like, oh, this is it. I got to read this now. And I think in some way, Rambam's doing the same thing, right? He's ending this chapter by saying, yeah, this stuff is the deepest knowledge there is accessible. And by the way, it's you know, it's only for special people. Let's move on. And that only makes you more interested, hopefully. Where he didn't quote from the Torah for a while, he's now boom, 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 quoting. All of those quotes are from the books traditionally attributed to Solomon, right? They're from Mishlei, Proverbs. They're from Shir HaShirim. And those are all Solomon books, along with Kohelet, which interesting, he doesn't reference here, but he quoted earlier. Just to conclude, we just have one more line. Kach Pershua Chamim Rishonim Devarim Shehen Hidvash V'chalav Yu Tachat Shonach. So the sages understood, the first sages understood, those are the Mishnah sages, that these things are like honey and milk under the tongue for those who understand them, of course. So he's saying there's a great benefit to this knowledge, but it's not for everyone, and it's quite difficult, and actually it's something that could really ruin your life. Nothing is more compelling. We'll notice, by the way, and just a little preview, and then we're going to stop for today because we got to the end of the chapter, that, you know, next chapter, we get a lot more down to brass tacks, I mean, relatively speaking, which is, he starts to teach us about astronomy, how he understands the planets. He's completely wrong, by the way, in case that's not obvious. He lived in a time in which the understanding of the planets and the solar system was vastly different from ours. But we can still, you know, forgive him for that, because he's only applying the best science he knew. And he would suggest that we do the same. But, you know, I say that only to point out that actually from chapter 3, we're really getting into more mundane. We're not really in philosophy anymore. We're in physics, and we'll eventually get down to law. And so these first two chapters that we've now completed are really his attempt to try and convey his entire philosophy in a short period of time and get us interested in more. And his other work, his other major work, The Guide for the Perplexed, is really where that happens more in depth. But fittingly, The Guide for the Perplexed isn't at all true to its name, because Maimonides purposely put the chapters out of order, and he wrote it in a way that's kind of in code, and this same kind of playful hiding, revealing, the person who figures it out fully will be able to understand it and everyone else is just screwed. It's a consistent approach throughout that work as well. And there's a hint of that here, although he's mostly going to focus on teaching us from now on. Any thoughts on this radical conception of God and why it matters to continue with our journey into the Mishneh Torah?
I'd love to say that at the end where you said, of course, he was wrong with his whole idea of the planets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When he wrote it, he thought he was correct. Yeah. We're saying he's wrong because at present we think we know.
That's right.
But in 200 years' time, someone will come along and they'll say, those people 200 years ago had no idea what they were talking about.
You know what, David, you're absolutely correct. What we should say is, according to the conception we have presently, Rambam is incorrect. I don't know that it'll come back to his conception, as we'll see next week.
This I didn't say that.
Crystal
I did
spheres
say that.
And concentric circles. But that's not to say that we have it right. This is also the person who said we should accept the truth from whatever source it comes. So I think he would be excited to discover that he has been outdated in his conception of the universe. Yeah,
I can't quite. I think it's similar to Jackie's question, but it's I can't quite get my head around why it's so controversial to believe that God is beyond our comprehension.
I guess if we think about, maybe all of us are already taking the first step towards enlightenment, which is being part of the Masorti community, obviously. But if you think about kind of the oppressive environment of many quote-unquote orthodox establishments, where asking any questions or thinking of God in any way different to the narrative that's been taught is seen as catastrophic. You know, he in many ways is acting as a guide to people to say, listen, there's another way to understand it, which he thinks is the true way. But he's aware of the danger of that idea. And it's certainly true, right? That if, and part, a lot of it, by the way, a lot of it, I think, has to do with what you think the mitzvot are for. The entire book is about the mitzvot, right? And if you believe that the mitzvot are there because God told you to do this, and if you don't do it, you're going to be in trouble, then God as a mosquito is not a very compelling commander, right? That relationship of commandedness doesn't really work with God as life itself, because that it's just different, right? Now, Maimonides doesn't think that's why the commandments exist. He thinks they're there for our sake, that they exist in order to improve us, to purify us, to draw out the better sides of ourselves, to train us to be better people. He sees them as a almost cognitive behavioral therapy, right? That by behaving in the way that we're commanded, we think better and act better and are better. He doesn't say that explicitly either, and he didn't know anything about CBT, but he definitely thinks in that way about the mitzvot. And again, I think that was quite radical in his world, in his time, to talk about the mitzvot that way. Most people, then as now, have a very simplistic pagan understanding of the mitzvot, which is the old sky beard told us to do this, and if we don't do it, he's going to throw lightning bolts at us. I mean, I'm being flippant, of course, but many of us still sometimes think that way, right? There's people at Yom Kippur in our own community who stand there and are feeling like, oh, I want to be written in the book of life and not the book of death, which is a nonsense idea, by the way. And so Rambam is someone who, if you put this front and center in many traditional Jewish communities and said, actually, you know, the mosquito that's stuck in the window pane is equally God as you are, and there's no distinction whatsoever, that would be a radically dangerous and destabilizing idea. I also think it's fantastic, but that's why I'm here and not there. But I can imagine lots of people would not enjoy that, especially people claiming authority over others to interpret how those commandments should be applied. In many ways, right, the real radical thing about this project of Rambam's is by virtue of writing the Mishnei Torah, you don't need a rabbi. You don't need someone to tell you what to do. You have a book which contains the law, which you can read and make your own decisions. I think that's probably the thing that was most threatening to many Jewish communities, is the democratization of knowledge that this book represents. Because prior to Rambam, if you wanted to learn the halakha, you had to spend 20 years in yeshiva studying the Gemara and the Talmud and understand it in depth. And then even then you still didn't know and you had to ask a rabbi. But with the Mishneh Torah, you could just open it and see what he says and then live your life. And that's something that is very threatening to authority, which is great. That's why we love him. And that's why we're hopefully going to be learning this for many years to come. But the philosophical, the intellectual, we're leaving slightly behind. Next week, we go into the astronomical, get our space goggles on. Daniel has the right background for next week. Keep that up. And we will be exploring the Aristotelian conception of the universe. As incorrect as it may now be, it's certainly insightful for us to get a sense of how he thought about the universe and how it jives with his understanding of Jewish conceptions.